Hello, everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your hosts, Jess Geyer. I am one half of Wannabe Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games. And I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Craig Campbell. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Jess. I'm Craig Campbell. I'm the owner of Nerdburger Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games. And for those of you who didn't know these things, if you're longtime listeners, you already know this. But if you didn't know this thing, if you're a new listener, maybe, we just taught you something about each of us. And that means a thing when it comes to what we're going to talk about today.
I almost just spit out my coffee.
I know, I'm watching both of them do spit takes. we'll pass that over to our guest first. Starshine, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me back. Yeah, I'm John Starshine Greenall. I am a TTRPG creator, writer, and sometimes artist. I'm like Katsune Miku. I'm hiding in your Wi-Fi.
I love having you on the show because the things that you say, only you can say them. I love it. Thanks for joining us.
I will say
today.
you are in no danger of ever like just being kind of cycled out of the podcast because you. I've said this to people. I've said this to Jess. I've said this to other people that I love having Starshine on the show, and I love having all of our guests on the show. But I have very specific reasons for everybody, and for Starshine, it's because you are incredibly well read and well versed in a wide variety of topics, some of which I know nothing about. So I always learn something when you're on the show.
Yes.
What a thrust.
Craig, please teach me. What are we talking about today?
Today we're talking about games that teach. and I think we can probably broaden that out to the idea of role-playing games teaching. Just role-playing or role-playing games in general as teaching. We may talk about specific games. We may talk about GMing kind of, as GMs, utilizing games that teach and finding ways to use them. Kind of integrating that into things. We might talk about it as, I don't know, from the perspective of, say, a teacher, Jess, maybe. A person who actually teaches professionally. And we may also, probably delve into the side of designing games in such a way that they teach something. And teaching, of course, is a very broad topic. You can teach a lot of different things, from straight up book smarts kind of things, like knowing things that are in books, to teaching social interaction and social cues and allowing people to practice things that they are learning and slowly kind of ingraining into their self. There's a lot. There's so much we could talk about with teaching, but we're going to try to talk about some really interesting parts of it here for the next hour or so.
Yeah, so Starshine, why did you pick this topic?
Because I quite like it as an idea. I like games. I think people learn a lot through games. Learning through play is a big thing that I'm interested in. I think it's really important. And if I may sort of brush up, I think an important thing to note here is this is a topic that's been bad research done on it. We're not just pulling this out. The idea of sort of role-playing games, TTRPG specifically, being used in classroom settings and being used to teach has been studied. Just cite a few papers that I personally really like. There is Glenberg, Gure's, and Levin's Activity and Imagined Activity Can Enhance Young Children's Reading Comprehension, which is in the Journal of Educational Psychology. There's a really good one by, I believe their names are Yabovich, Fizladin, and Yugonovich. I'm probably saying those wrong. But it's improving communicative language skills through role-playing activity. And the one I cite a lot is Wildley's and Uwe's Scoping Review of Tabletop Role-Playing Games as Psychological Intervention. All do really good things. And all, as much as a paper can sort of show there is a benefit, they point towards there being benefits to this. I think, for years, these things haven't been studied much. But in the last decade, we're seeing more people actually study them. So obviously, while we're... Today, we're not doing a proper full sort of literature evaluation, but I do want to sort of start off by saying, there is actual scholarship here that shows that these have a benefit in your game. You don't feel that you think, I want to teach via games. Don't feel like you're doing something weird. Because obviously, I think there is that thing that, especially in a sort of American, Canadian, British classrooms, the idea of play and education tend to have a hard line drawn down the middle of them. Mm-hmm. That is not true. They can be used for this. So I think it's an interesting field, and I like talking about interesting things with you too.
Yes, it is changing. I've certainly noticed it from the time where I was in high school to the time now as a teacher. Games and play, it has become super, super popular, especially as technology has become more prevalent in the classroom. Now, this doesn't really have a lot to do with like role-playing games, but there's technology like Kahoot, Blookit, GymKit. Even Quizlet has gamification in it now. The idea of gamification in learning has become super popular. And I would say that you see a lot more games in classroom and play in classroom in American classrooms now. I don't know. I can't speak for the Canadian school system or the British school system, however. In fact, this summer, I had the pleasure of, I'm a French teacher. I had the pleasure of receiving a scholarship. Thank you to the Embassy of France, as well as the, oh gosh, a lot of different programs came together to get me over to San Diego this summer, and I got to learn from Aide Silva, who is the head of language and literature didactics at the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de Mexico, and she is an expert. She has a doctorate in literary theory. She has degrees also in things like game science, and she teaches how to put play and games in your language classroom to increase interaction, and to increase your language skills across the board. So that includes like your knowing how to do things, like how to interact and behave, as well as your language skills. So both like the, I don't know how to translate these things into English, but like your language skills and like your everything, basically. I don't know how to translate it well into English, but it was wonderful. And it's like it's becoming like you said, Starshine, it's becoming much more researched, especially in the last couple decades.
I'm sorry, Jess, but I do have to say that I'm really tickled over you stumbling over your words when describing language skills.
I know. I
Just
know.
conceptually, that was fun.
You don't need to have language skills to teach them. It's got to be one lesson ahead of the student. It's fine.
that's true.
But yeah, I adore using play and games. I use them in my classroom all the time. I use role play in my classroom a lot. And I think that I've always said being a teacher and being a game master and being a game designer, yes, there are three circles, but there's a huge overlap in this Venn diagram between the three. And the best game designers I know are also teachers, and the best teachers I know are also game designers. So let's talk. Like, what can we do? I don't know if it would really be like benefit us to kind of separate this into game like GMing and writing games when we're talking about educational games that teach. But yeah,
We can float back and forth. We
we'll
can
float
just
back.
let
I
it go
think
where it
there,
goes.
for me, this one is like one of the same, right?
I
So
think there's a good point you maybe made with that, though, is that when you are running a game to teach, I do feel that you have to be a more, you have to also sort of design as you go a little bit. Obviously, a teacher in a classroom needs to understand their game on a level that maybe sort of someone picking one up for their game night doesn't have to. So they are more involved in the design process. I will say it's probably my first thing. If you're playing games to teach, you actually have to be a slightly more focused GM than you normally would. And that often means sort of keeping a tight leash on the game. And normally we encourage sort of just go with the flow. And if players go off on something, let them. That doesn't work as much in education. So I think you do have to be slightly tighter and going in with that much more solid focus of what do I want to teach? What do each of my mechanics aim to get the I'm gonna say the children back to that a lot, but get the players to do and really sort of focus in on those core elements at every moment you can.
having a learning objective is the parlance we would use in education. What is your objective? Like, what are you trying to teach? And having that kind of set down is your first step if you're playing or running an educational game. So if you're playing in Spirales, like, well, okay, obviously the learning objective here is to learn a little sign language. And that is different sometimes. Like knowing like what the difference between your educational objective is, your learning objective, and then the game objective, those can be two different things. Like the game objective is what the players are doing, what they're hoping to achieve. Like maybe the game objective in this session that we're running is to save this forest from the bulldozers that are coming. Like, that is the game objective. And then the learning objective would be like, let's learn about the, like, you will be able to identify dangers that are happening to the rainforest, or you'll be able to identify ways of to use direct action to stop environmental destruction. Those are, they're separate, and the closer you can kind of get those aligned, the more authentic your learning experience will be in the game. Like, if your objective is you're going to learn how to multiply with decimals, and then your game objective is like way, way different than that, it's going to be harder to kind of marry those two.
Yeah, especially to note with classroom games is that they're going to have a much more limited time frame as well. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you can get away with that. It's sort of, again, we talk about sort of free form game nights. You can get away if a game runs an hour over. A teacher cannot have their plan session run an hour over. That causes problems. So, having that focus and making sure those ideas are aligned is much more important if you're planning on having a game that teaches in a formal setting, even in for sort of not just in schools, which is I'm going to default to quite a lot by accident, simply because most of the teachers I know are sort of early years. Mm-hmm. But still, even like in a university setting, you're going to have your game's going to have a fixed time it has to run with the students. They have limited time in their day. You can't go an hour over because they've got five other classes to be at. They've got something else. So making sure that focus is there is really important. And with your educational sort of and learning goals, something I want to bring up is, I think if you're designing a game, avoid something I've seen a lot is trying to be too clever. Mm. I've seen a few games that try and teach, sort of try and have a secondary point slip in through mechanics. So I'm trying to think of a good way of saying this without giving away what game it was. But I saw one that was basically, it was trying to make a very fair point about certain groups by saying, oh, you can play as the evil people, but they have bad mechanics. They physically can't win. I've made sure they can never get enough points to win. If you present that to any group of teenagers or kids, they will immediately tell what you're doing and will deliberately start playing as the evil people to try and break your game. Like, don't try and be like, oh, look, I've made sure that you can be the bad people. Like, don't, it's not worth it. People will immediately, people don't like being preached to, and they'll immediately tell you're messing with them and just go, well, okay, I'm going to purposely go against you. So if you want to do something, like I said, with the rainforest one, it's best to just be heart on your sleeve a little bit there and just be very forward with that. You're going to get much more interaction and much more sort of open players than you are if you try and like educate them through the back door by being like, oh, look, is it this mechanically bad? They're not going to care.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, especially with a younger audience, I feel like you could get away with it a little bit more. And we kind of talked about this in our last episode. We were talking about games with a political or another type of clear message. If you have a group of people that already have the buy-in, they're less likely to try to mess stuff up. But you're right, people don't like to be preached to. When you're teaching somebody something, you already are kind of putting yourself in a position of authority over them, and that can make people feel a certain way. And like, if I'm playing an educational game at Gen Con with a group of five strangers, and I'm like, ooh, what did you, like, ooh, we're learning, ooh, like, why am I assuming that me and you don't know the same thing? Why am I making those assumptions? Why am I putting myself in that authority position over you? But if I'm coming out with it, like, hey, we're going to explore this, we're going to learn about this, we're going to learn how to do these things, yeah, people are a little happier about that. I also hate being moralized too, so I understand.
And also just to think about sort of how your mechanics interact, because yeah, in that same game had probably my favorite accidental thing in the world. The evil people you could play as had the most fun mechanic.
Oh no!
Think about who your audience is, because again, specifically this game had the evil people got this sort of very interactive mechanic where you could run around and annoy the other players. It's like, if I'm a kid, I'm going to want to play that mechanic, because that's, everyone else had quite dry mathematical dice rolling. Of course the kid's going to go, I want to be the one who gets to run and steal the other player's dice.
Right, so, I want to be the class clown. I want to be annoying.
I don't want to sit here for 2 hours. I want to run around. So do think about that. If you're building mechanics, make sure that your mechanics are actually feeding into your learning objective, and you don't have a situation where you're basically giving the things you don't. Again, it is classical conditioning. Encourage the behavior you want to see. If you're trying to say this isn't good, don't make the this isn't good have the most fun mechanic.
Yeah. I find myself thinking, about the idea of knowing your audience, knowing who it is you're trying to teach and what you might expect their reaction to be to certain things. And this plays into like Starshine talking about like the situation where you tell everybody like if you play the evil people, you can't possibly win. Well, that's if it's a teacher and student, that there's an authority and there's an authority power dynamic, right? And so like there's the likelihood that the students or the players are going to be like, I'm going to push back against the authority, because when you're young and you don't like being told what to do and so forth, that's a natural thing to do. And so like knowing that, like that's going to be a likely outcome or likely choice made by the audience that you're working with teaching, is keeping that in mind. And, then you won't, you know, ultimately not get yourself kind of backed into a corner in a situation where now I can't teach realistically because what I've taught the kids is the wrong thing. Like I've taught them to fight against this teaching exercise.
maybe that is the learning objective. How can we fight?
Well, kids, we didn't actually accomplish anything today. And what did we learn from that?
We learned that being rowdy is fun. All right.
Woo! Oh, that wasn't what I was going for.
I'm not getting funding next year.
I think yes, teaching via the mechanics is important, but you can also teach directly through like the narrative that you're providing for your players too. And this is especially effective, like even if you're playing with adults. I have learned so much from playing games. I've learned so many like interesting little facts and like little knowledge from playing games, not TTRPG related, but like the Nancy Drew games. I've learned so much about a wide variety of things from playing those games. I had a great GM back in Michigan who often incorporated a lot of real research, a lot of real history into his games. And I learned a lot about history through playing his games. So my dog is bothering me. Balder, go lay down. Go lay down.
He's got an opinion. I mean.
Yeah, he has an opinion. What do you want to teach us, Balder? So if you're like really passionate about a subject, like you just learned about the Haymarket incident in Chicago, and you want to incorporate that into your game, you want to incorporate that into one of your role-playing sessions, you could also share your knowledge in not an info dumpy way with your players by incorporating that into the narrative that you're doing for the day. And that can be a really fun way for people to learn more about history, even if they might already know it, because that could still be fun for people who already know about it, and it could be really eye-opening for people who don't.
I mean, there's a long tradition of that as well. You look at reenactment groups, medieval ones, I'm from the English Civil War, what are probably one of the biggest outreach things for a lot of periods of history. When done well, it can be a really good educational tool to show people things they wouldn't know and get easier buy-in by making it feel less dry. Because it's one thing saying, oh, this is what sort of a flanking maneuver looks like on paper, then you see it in person, right, or you get a chance to be, and you go, oh, you suddenly go, wow, this was this massive scale event.
And it's those simulationist type games that are really, really popular in schools too. Like one that we're all really familiar with, I'm sure, is the Oregon Trail, which is a simulationist game about taking the Oregon Trail in the United States, going from one end of the country to the other, and kind of what goes into that with real locations and real things you might do. I mean, it's not really great looking back at it as a completely educational tool, but that's an example of that.
I think it's all about dysentery.
Do people still do in school? I know it's something I've seen on TV shows, and I've heard about people kind of doing it in the, you know, in the past, like when I was younger, when, you know, people who are older now were younger. Is it still a thing now? Like the World Council thing where you get everybody together,
yes, and
everybody portrays a person from a different country, and you're all trying to come to an agreement on something. And so you're kind of role playing in the form of the interests of that country and the things that country wants to get out of whatever agreement or, you know, debate you're having. That's an aspect of that. Like Starshine mentioned, like you dipped your toe into my wheelhouse, where I did 6 years performing at the Bristol Renaissance Fair. And the Renaissance Fair, the Bristol Fair at the time, was extremely historically accurate. We prided ourselves, and we worked very hard to be historically accurate. It was the Elizabeth's the first reign. We were specifically set in the year 1574, which is the year that Elizabeth Tudor went to the town of Bristol on her royal progress. So you have to learn what you learn. You teach the people what the royal progress was, which was when the monarch and their whole retinue went out into the countryside, because London was a cesspool of disease during the hot summer months, and they would travel around and stay with all the nobles, and the nobles would have to pay for it because you have to keep the monarch happy. And they would go out and see the country that way. And that was the way for people to actually get a chance to, like, kind of celebrate the monarch and say something, you know, and see them. And like, it was a big, big, big day for the people, and they would have festivals and all this sort of thing. And when we were doing that, we were portraying, like, I was for a few years, I was in the court, and we were portraying like actual people from the history, from the period, you know, learning their histories, playing those characters. And that, you know, extends over, I think, into historic role-playing games that are set in history, or in an alternate history where maybe there's just a few things that have been tweaked a little bit, but it is otherwise largely, you know, actual history. So like speaking to the Haymarket incidents, where you could have a game where there's like, oh, there's a fantastical thing that happens in this game world where like people have some special powers or whatever ability, but it's set otherwise, but it's otherwise it's the world. Like it's the United States at that time. And you can work in all sorts of actual historical events. That becomes a method of teaching through where, you know, if it's gamified with mechanics and dice and or some other randomizer or whatever, that's great. If it's a game that's like if it's a role playing game that is dice less, or, you know, without mechanics, or maybe uses a point system, or is entirely improvisational, or if it's just role play, which is when you really get right down to it. You know, my 6 summers doing the Ren Fair was, you know, improv oriented. I had my history and background, and I kind of developed a character, but it was otherwise just improvising and knowing how to work with people, develop, you know, reading social cues, learning the rules of how we interact in this environment, which is not terribly different from the real world. It's just that we're all on the same page and moving toward the same goal. And our objective there is to present a slice of life, and to teach the audience while also entertaining. I miss it, but I really think about it. I had a lot of fun doing it. But you know, that improvisational side, has, you know, become, you know, a big reason that I love role-playing games in general. So, and I think, like if you're working with children or teenagers, there's still hope for them, because there's so many adults who kind of lose the ability to play, and that's a little disheartening. What you can be doing when you're teaching and using role playing and role playing games for teaching is also in the process, you're teaching the students, the players, that look at me, like play is a thing you can continue to do, and you can continue to get value out of it, and you can continue to have fun with it, but you can also, like, you know, use it for purposes outside of just like entertaining yourself and your friends.
Yeah, so you actually hit on something I think is quite important there with how you were saying about interacting with different groups. A big thing to think of with educational games is making sure you do have that accessibility in mind, to think about how different groups are going to interact with your game. Obviously, if you're working with a mixed group of adults and children, you need to make sure that both adults and children can enjoy the game. You know, obviously, if you're working with something that's going to have, you know, 5-year-old little Jimmy and his dad turning up, you can't sort of make a game the dad that's very heavy on the math, because the dad can do it, but little Jimmy's doomed. But at the same time, you need to make sure that, you know, the dad has something that he can do. Again, so a free-form sort of LARP is really good for that, though it does have its problems. Hilarity, that was the issue with, if you ever saw it, or the video about it, Evermore Park, the LARP park, failed that entirely. There was either kids couldn't do anything, or the adults were bored out of their minds. But also, the thing to consider there, which was also a problem Evermore had, actually, is language. If you are working with a big group, you have to factor in that not everyone is going to have the same English language skill, or whatever the primary language of your player is. You need to make sure that you communicate across that. A big difference, I would argue, between sort of normal TTRPG groups and sort of normal LARP groups and these public educational events is that they are less self-selecting. A LARP group, you tend to be all right because, yeah, most, not same with most TTRPG groups, most people are only going to go to a group if they feel comfortable with it already. In an educational setting or in a classroom setting especially, they don't have a choice. So you've got to think, can this be reached by everyone I'm going to be dealing with today? Is this classroom, if two or three students do not have that sort of English experience, you need to make sure that you either offer things in their language or have it simple enough to be understood. It's one of the stupidest things I've ever dealt with is when I made a game last year for an educational compendium called Roll for Learning. And mine was like, I want to do something for very young children about sort of verbs and their opposites. So mine was rats making dinner. I got to think of what food do they make? I ended up doing pizza simply because pizza is one of the only foods that is international. Every country has a form of pizza. And it's one of the only foods that retains its name across languages. It's a loan word in pretty much everything. Plus, it's one of the only dishes I could think of that could be made kosher, could be made vegetarian, could be made halal. So it doesn't matter what your group is, they should all have a grounding of what pizza is. It will be a little bit different in certain classrooms, but in theory, I can go pizza, and I can be pretty sure whatever room I'm in, at least 90%, 99% will understand what I'm meaning and won't have I feel excluded because I can't have that in the real world. It's little things like that.
It's a really important thing to do. It's something you have to think about a lot as a teacher is your audience, your classroom. What needs do they have? Luckily, in most classrooms, you're typically dealing with people who are around the same level of skills, but you're still going to have people at a lower skill level and a higher skill level. Like in my classroom, I also have a lot of English language learners. So even though I'm teaching French, you know, when I have to default to like explain something in another language, I'm defaulting to English, and not all of my students have that same skill, but they're pretty much all the same skill level of French. So things that you could do, you could add scaffolds there. So like what I mean by a scaffold would be like, how can I bridge my students, like the players of this game who are at a lower level? What bridges can I give them so they can reach the learning objective itself? What do they need? Do they need a dictionary? Do they need a glossary? Do they need a buddy? What do they need? Do they need a smaller group where I am helping facilitate? Also, breaking them up into smaller groups and differentiating what they're doing can also help. So giving, for example, a game that I have played to great success, which is a type of role-playing game. The objective is to discuss something, whether it's in the target language or otherwise. So each of them are in a small group and they are supposed to be sharing. And I tell them, okay, you're either going to be a president or an ambassador. And if you're the president, your job is to listen to all of the ambassadors from the other countries who are going to come to you and explain what their group is doing, or they're going to talk about their topic. And you're going to take notes. And then when all the ambassadors come home, you're going to discuss it together, and you're going to have to answer a question. But secretly, I also make some of them spies. And I only make the students who are higher level be spies if I want them to do something more advanced. Like I want them to learn something else sneakily, or I can make my lower level students be the spies, and their job is to do something that's a much more simple task, like ask everybody what their name is, like a lower level task. That way everyone gets to participate in some way. And then you have this hidden role aspect and they're getting way more into it. They have more buy-in, which is another important part. So there's lots of different ways you can kind of handle the mismatch nature of a gaming group. I feel like it's not as big of, like you said, Starshine, and or I think Craig, you might have also mentioned this too, in your regular role-playing game experience, the people who are at the table are going to be pretty equivalent. There's not going to be a huge gap in ability to meet your objective right away. But if you're playing for, like, let's say some of them are children, some of them are adults, or some of them are from, like, maybe I'm playing to a group of two people from Chicago, and then the other four are from different countries. They're not from the United States, let alone from Chicago, and the game is about the Haymarket Affair or even the World's Fair in Chicago. The people from Chicago are gonna know, maybe I don't know, a lot of people don't know about Haymarket. They're gonna know a little bit more. They're gonna have more context than the other people, and you don't want to give them necessarily an unfair advantage, quote unquote, in the game. You don't want them to be able to use their knowledge to have a better time than everybody else. I don't know. That's actually the toughest thing to do in as a teacher anyway, is the differentiation and scaffolding and making sure all students are meeting, having their needs met. That's
hard. To confidence as well. We talk a lot about sort of, again, role-playing groups, they tend to self-select. If you're not sort of a big fan of public speaking or you feel nervous playing a role, you're probably not going to sign up to come to D&D. Or whatever right. tabletop group. And obviously in the classroom, that kid doesn't get the choice. So you do need those elements in place, both scaffolding and mechanically, to make sure that every kid, even if they're not dramatically confident, can do something of value. And sort of just to ease them in. Like, don't expect, you know, that this little Jimmy, who, you know, is very shy, to be able to jump into a game with hard role-playing elements immediately. Give him a way to feel useful and build his confidence through little bits over time. And yes, that's something you definitely need to be very aware of. And yet, even in sort of non-classroom settings, if you're doing something with the public as an event, you're less likely to get a sort of like TTRPG first audience.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a side point. The thing you're going to be dealing with, and something I really recommend, is to remember that in a lot of educational settings, you may not be dealing with that TTRPG first audience. They were coming in for whatever the learning is, not whatever the game was. So do be aware that, you know, they may not know certain TTRPG terms. You can have a situation, and I've had it with people who have run educational games. You get someone come in and they've no idea what a D20 is. They've never seen one. There's like there's six-sided ones in Monopoly. That is their line.
Mm.
So you do have to be very clear with this. I would also say if you're planning on giving something to other facilitators, so making a game for other teachers to use, you probably should include sort of probably a more detailed breakdown than you'd usually do for a TTRPG audience. As we said earlier, have what is your learning? Have a piece at the end saying, this is the learning objectives of this game. Here's how everything interacts. Here's the aim of each mechanic. Just so those other people know what you were getting at and can then more easily tailor it to their game, to their group. Much like how an SRD for hacking would break things down for another designer. Think about that for whatever your facilitator is. Think what would they want to know to run this game if they're coming in with no knowledge at all of games and are just sort of dipping their toes in.
That's such a good point. It's like just even the knowledge, even the game-based language knowledge is really important. You could always, of course, inventory. You could always survey your players before you start to know what you need to cover. But sometimes that doesn't go the way you might expect. Sometimes you take for granted what your audience knows or doesn't know. I think that's a huge thing to prepare for in advance, thinking about what they don't know versus what they do know. Because you also don't want to go over stuff again that they already do know. That's a way for people to check out.
Yeah, amazing. When I was working on a different game, I talked to the teacher and they were very polite. They were lovely. But we're talking about Powered by the Apocalypse. Like, oh, your game's very powered by episode PBTA. And they didn't stop me, tell me they had no idea what I was talking about. So they're like, oh, yeah. So they just thought, like, was a term. It's like, oh, yeah, no, I'm glad you think my game's very puppeteer. It's like, I didn't. You didn't tell me you had no idea what I was saying, did you?
I'm going to start calling it Bubata.
That's what I do now. But it was like, again, I didn't think of that. I just, because I'm so used to talking to a TTRPG owner when talking design, when helping them with this, my first thing was like, oh, this is this. Of course, they didn't even, they didn't know what it was at all. So me saying, oh, it's like this or check this was meaningless to them. So do think if you're working with that non-audience.
Be careful with jargon and acronyms and abbreviated speech. You know, I'm sure all of us can relate to this at some point in some way. It happens to me regularly in my job. I work for clients that love to speak in their jargon and a lot of or a lot of acronyms, and it drives me up the wall because I have to like try to figure out what they're talking about from context, and sometimes you can't, or you have to ask it a question and you feel dumb, which you shouldn't, but I still do. Or try to look it up and piece it together by like equating some things. I don't know. That's okay. My little rant aside.
No, that
was just me complaining about my clients.
It's true. It's a big problem in education too, is using a bunch of jargon. Like, oh, my school's doing this initiative, and so therefore I think everybody else knows this terminology. And then they come, they start talking to other people, and they start using this terminology. I've gone to interviews where I was interviewing at a school, and they started asking you about this initiative that they do using their terms and their acronyms. There's so many acronyms in education. So I can totally see a teacher being like, I totally, definitely know what that means. And there's so many of them. And, oh gosh, jargon. Yeah.
As role players, we love our jargon. Yeah, be careful.
Do. Oh, well, we do. We have a lot of, especially our PFAs, have a lot of very specific things that, I think, especially when we're doing TTRPG things, the thing to consider is that I think there's probably a very technical term for it. I do not know it, but a lot of people have had just enough interaction with games to know some of it, but not to know our specific end of it. The old joke about everyone loves Monopoly whenever you bring up D&D is a thing to keep in mind. People may know this very specific type of gameplay and sort of board gameplay. You may have to sort of break them out of that a little bit, gently and kindly. So just, be aware of terms you're using. Be aware of communication and be aware of your audience. And if you're handing something off to a teacher who may not know this, something else I'd bring up is be aware of resources. I mean, it's very fair for us to say, oh yeah, just get 25 D4. We all have 25 D4 in the house, right? But if you're handing it off to a classroom setting with a, say, or a group setting, that might not be around, especially your facilitator may not have. Yeah, if they're not new to games, they'll be like, well, again, I have my 16 copies of Monopoly, I can pull the D6s out, but I'm not going to have D100s or roll downs available. Make sure, I would argue when working with education games, if you're going to hand them off, it's probably best to pare back specific resources. But if you're not, make sure it's very upfront. This is what you need. This is what it is. Very clearly, like, you won't just need dice. You will need 25 D4s and you'll need 28 Ds. Specific. Because again, especially for teachers, they can't often buy stuff themselves. They will have to go through a head or someone else to get those resources. I've worked with libraries in the past. It's not just a case of popping down the shop and buying some. It has to be requisitioned. So basically giving them that list of like, here's what you will need to send to the person who does your buying. There we go.
Or the teacher does have to buy it out of their pocket, which is the case in the United States quite often. And I know I'm not gonna purchase an educational game where I also have to purchase $100 of supplies. It's not gonna happen. I'll do something else instead.
Especially when you're interacting with children as well, because let's face it, children and items leads to things getting lost, leads to things getting broken. So if your game does need a lot of stuff and you're aiming it at kids, maybe pare it back. If the teachers have to rebuy that $100 of stuff every half term, they're gonna very quickly go, this isn't worth it. I will find something else.
Absolutely.
And think about how much use you might get out of something, how many times you'll actually get, value out of something for its money.
And I mean, that's true too. If you overplay a game with your students, they start losing interest in it. It's no longer as fun for them. The novelty has worn off, and you want them to kind of have that novelty and the fun experience. That's what activates your neurons. That's what's getting you to take the short-term memory to the long-term memory, which is the goal that we're trying to do for our students, getting them to associate these positive emotions with their learning. So you don't want to overdo it. You don't want to play it more than a couple times. I say, like, as soon as my students ask me to play a game, I'm like, no, we're not going to play that right now. And kind of take that off the table, off the shelf, and play something else instead. So there's that. And I forgot the other thing I was going to say, so that's fine. I started off like I was going to say two things, and I could only remember
It's
the one.
conversation
Well,
failed there. Evade your neurons.
you know what that's a sign of, Jess, is you have a lot of things to say because you know a lot of things about these topics. And so sometimes, yeah, something just slips.
I just ran a couple weeks ago. I ran a session for teachers about ludopedagogy, so it's slightly fresh in my mind. I had a whole presentation on it.
I was also that's pedagogy. So I'm glad to hear someone else say it properly because I've been trying to avoid saying it. I'm never entirely sure how you say that.
Ludopedagogy.
Pedagogy. See,
Yeah,
I learned
pedagogy,
something.
ludopedagogy.
Just I want to sort of come into a general point, which I think we've been touching on with your Haymarket comments a bit. But if you are going to make a game about a serious topic, make sure you handle it well. Do have a think and do reach out to groups. You can do TTRPGs, education ones, for very big topics and for very upsetting topics. I will point out, if you ever sort of want to look at educational LARPs, Lizzie Stark's The Curse is one of, I would argue, the best. It is about breast cancer. It is very heavy, and obviously, I believe Ms. Clark, I can't remember from my head, either she suffered from it or one a close family member did, but she clearly did the research. It's handled very tactfully. It's very clear this is done from a position of love. If you are touching something like that, just don't think I'm going to teach about this big topic and then fail to it. Again, if you're doing something like I said, we talked about the Haymarket. There's a lot of other history tied into American history, racial history, a big thing. Make sure you're getting those sensitivity readers in. Make sure you're talking with affected groups. It's very easy, even with the You may have the best of intentions, but it's so easy to just misunderstand something or slip into an area where you're encouraging something you'd rather not.
Absolutely.
It's better to do that early than it is to do it at the end and realize you've made something horrible.
Absolutely. Thank you for the recommendation too. I've just put that in my notes app.
Oh, recommendations?
Oh yeah,
I have
let's talk
recommendations. We've
recommendations.
got some topic toward the end here. We
Yeah.
recommended a few different things up at the top of the hour. I follow on social media and occasionally discuss, chit chat back and forth with somebody from TTRPG Kids, which is a website full of resources for educational tabletop RPGs for kids and teens. That's a fun little read and sort of all sorts of interesting things that you might be able to use if you're doing something anywhere from Jess, who's works professionally as a teacher, to like, well, you're doing a summer course on something, or you're teaching something at the community college or at a community center or something like that. Like these things can extend beyond. We've talked a lot about kind of framing it by actual schools, but there is school in a lot of other places than the building that we call a school. There's a lot of teaching opportunities and learning opportunities. So check that out. Also, a note about a TEDx talk by John Arcadian, who is a longtime gamer and a game designer. He did a TEDx talk called Role-Playing Games as Social Practice. It's a good listen and watch, talking
John
about
Arcadian, inspiration for Possum's Bar at in Moonpunk. So
So that gets into the idea of that we as human beings have always, from very, very young age, used role playing as a way to practice being social and social and developing social skills, learning social cues, and so forth, and how we can continue to do that as adults and use it for social practice and social discovery and personal and identity discovery too. As we've talked about in the game before, you know, there many a gamer has played a queer character who did not consider themselves queer, did not identify as queer, played a game as a queer character, and suddenly was like, you know what, there's some things that have not made sense in my life, and this is actually shining some light, and maybe I'm going to explore this in myself a little bit.
If you hang around in egg meme spaces, then yeah, that you'll see that's like, you can have academic papers, which are great, but you look at that, you go with those spaces, and you say, oh, right, yeah, no, this is just more proof than I think no paper would accept this as proof, but it's definitely social proof of, oh, that's a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, experience is also an important method of learning about the world. So
sometimes you touch the stove.
Do not touch any stoves. We are not encouraging you to touch stoves.
I'm going to go touch a stove right now because I am the only person who lives here and I know that my stove is cold. I'm looking at it right now and I can see that it is cold because it's not glowing and the light that says hot surface. I know it works because it worked this morning.
Please edit in the goofy scream now.
Yeah. Hold on while I touch the stove. Well, that was a bad idea.
So I'll talk about recommendations. I would say a really good book I enjoy is Role-Playing Art, Collecting Experience of Role-Playing. It's got a few essays in it. One of my personal favorites is Henriksen's Games and Creativity and Learning. Another one that I think I found really interesting personally was Magic, Adventure, and Social Participation, Tabletop Role-Playing Games and Their Potential to Promote Social Inclusion. Should have taken a breath midway through that, by Anna M. Goodall, which was a very interesting little read. And as for games that do teach, obviously we've mentioned Inspirals, I believe that's probably the biggest modern example. That's the one that teaches you sign language. Again, The Curse by Lizzie Stark. I just recommend looking at The Curse. Probably in the morning before you've had a bad day. Don't do it after a bad day. It's grim. Another one I recently enjoyed is Story Guider. It's a TTRPG designed for pre-K children. Very simple, very... personally, I'd recommend it in general. I think it's a really good example of how to make a game where keeping things as accessible and as simple as possible while still having a game element. It's very well done, very clever. And one I should talk about that's upcoming, it's not out yet, is Academic Choices and Existential Perils by Joe Schofield and Jessica R. Lowry. I met them recently at EternalCityTable.com. They showed me this game. And it was one of those, it's for university students, basically about stress and dealing with stress-related issues. Brilliant. It's one of those games, I read it and immediately went, why hasn't this been in my life for the last 10 years? Why does it not exist till now? It feels like something that, so naturally written. So when that eventually comes out, I would recommend having a look at it.
For games that teach specifically as well, I'd point out Dialect, a game about language and how it dies by Thorny Games. It's a exercise in creating a community and its language, and learning how culture, community, and language are interconnected, and how you know, how some of those things, when one declines, on the associated ones can, and it digs all into that, and made by people who have studied that sort of thing.
I'm going to recommend a blog. I'm going to recommend the Molten Sulfur blog, which is by Tristan Zimmerman. It is a blog about a bunch of historical things that have happened, real life things, real cool things you could add to your RPGs, and history, folklore, all of that. Is any award winning? Is it nominated? I don't remember if it was award winning or nominated. Doesn't matter. It's great. And is a great way for you to learn about those cool things to then insert into your game so your players can also learn about them too.
The guests that we have on here, Matthew Orr is on regularly. Brandon Ayton has been on once. They are partners for Wet Ink Games. They do a weekly called like Wednesday Ink. And then there's another thing they do occasionally called Other Ink, where they talk to people from other game companies. And Tristan Zimmerman that we just talked about, he's a regular guest on there, and he talks that, like, when he comes on, that's what they do. They talk about like this one or more historical events and how you can gamify and insert them into games. So if you don't want to read the blog, you can go at least listen to Tristan talk about it, and you will find Tristan to be an incredibly loquacious and excitable, and like he's clearly very passionate about it. So like it's a very engaging listen.
Yeah. I mean, I've always said that teaching and gaming are, and learning and gaming, they're so intrinsically linked. It is, in my opinion, the most natural way for us to learn is via play. And you're never too old to play and learn at the same time. So I really appreciated having this conversation. Starshine, do you have any final thoughts?
No, I'm just going to echo what you said. Play is good. We should be doing more of it in general. Get your play quotas up, children. TTRPGs is a great way to do that. And I'm really hoping in the next 10 years, we sort of build more on this. Because this is a new area of research that it's getting some traction, but not as much. And like, really what I'm hoping is we finally shake the idea of play and education being these two separate houses while both alike in dignity can never interact. Because it's not true. They are so inherently interlinked.
Well, maybe if one of them poisons themselves and the other one stabs themselves, we'll figure it out.
I just want to point something out. This is not a video podcast. And I don't know if you two noticed it here or ever notice it with me, Jess, but I've come to notice it in myself, and then this is something that I like about myself, and I want people to think about this and do it too, which is when I hear somebody talking about something that they're knowledgeable on and that they are very passionate about, it makes me happy. And I found myself and literally thinking, I'm smiling right now simply because Jess is talking about scaffolding. Because it's something that's come up on the show before. You've mentioned it kind of briefly here and there, described kind of very briefly what it is, but you kind of got into a whole discussion and related it to, you know, teaching in RPGs and all this sort of thing. And I would just like to pass that along to everybody as a positive note for the day, is like when you see or hear somebody really getting into something that they love, a great way to respond to that is to just smile and be happy that they've got a thing they love.
Yay. Starshine, thank you for joining us today. And Craig, also thank you for those. That was very nice. That was a little brainer. But Starshine, thank you for joining us. It's always so wonderful to have you on.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Where can we find you and your stuff?
Yeah, I work at Starshine Scribbles. You can find my games at starshinescribbles.itch.io. You can find my website where all my stuff is at starshinescribbles.com. And I'm also the runner of libraryofwords.com, which is a TTRPG review site focused on small games. Our aim is to, as we joke, to cover the games no one else will. So yeah, if you like indie games, especially sort of small experimental ones, come have a look. We have covering up, not sure what the next article is by the time it releases, but recently we've been going through a few really interesting games.
Awesome. You can find me and myself at oneofthegames.com, or you should go to oneofthegames.itch.io. That's the best place to go. Oh, and I'm on Blue Sky at Joska. There.
And I am at Nerdburger Craig on various social medias. My website is nerdburgergames.com. And you can find the games, the hardcovers there. You can find all the games and PDFs too at drivethroughrpg.com. And if you want to challenge yourself to try to find a way to use a game to teach where the game is not really about teaching, at least I don't think so, and maybe somebody will tell me I'm wrong, you can check out Slay to Win on Kickstarter in May. It's a monster fighty role-playing card game, and I don't think it teaches you anything other than it teaches you the rules.
Teaches you how to count cards. It'd be a good primer for card counting.
Thank you to StephSax for our opening and closing theme song, which is Avel, licensed under Creative Commons. Thank you, StephSax, and thanks all of you for listening. And we'll see you back here next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.